Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with Al Jazeera. Sarah Mullally enthroned as first female Archbishop of Canterbury. Sarah Mullally has been formally installed as Archbishop of Canterbury, marking the start of her public ministry as the first woman to lead the Church of England. On March 25th, the former nurse took her seat on the 13th century chair of St. Augustine at Canterbury Cathedral before 2,000 guests that included heir to the British throne, Prince William, and his wife Catherine, as well as Prime Minister Keir Starmer and religious leaders. She will serve as the spiritual head of the Global Anglican Communion, which has about 85 million members worldwide. The Church of England ordained its first female priests in 1994 and its first female bishop in 2015. Although she legally took up the role in January, the installation marked the symbolic start of her ministry. As I begin my ministry today as Archbishop of Canterbury, I say again to God, "Here I am," she told the congregation as she delivered her inaugural sermon. Wearing a golden mitre, Mullally prayed for peace to prevail in war-ravaged regions of the world, including parts of the Middle East, Ukraine, Sudan, and Myanmar. The 63-year-old acknowledged the sufferings caused by the Church's past safeguarding failures, one of which caused her predecessor, Justin Welby, to resign, stressing the need to remain committed to truth, compassion, justice, and action. Welby stepped down in 2024 following a child abuse cover-up scandal. At the start of the ceremony, Mullally knocked on the cathedral's west door, wearing a cope secured by a clasp modeled on the belt she wore as a National Health Service nurse. She was then greeted by children, as prayers and readings in multiple languages, including Urdu, rang through the cathedral during the service. Mullally also wore a ring given to her by one of her predecessors, Michael Ramsay, by Pope Paul VI in 1966. A symbol of improving ties between Anglicans and Catholics, centuries after King Henry VIII split from the Roman Catholic Church. Earlier, Bishop Philip Mountstephen, who blessed her as she was installed in the diocesan chair during the service, told the Reuters news agency that the arrival of a woman in an ancient office older than the crown was a historic occasion. "It does signal a huge change that has taken place in the life of the church," Mountstephen said. A family with a shared root. While Mullally's appointment in October drew sharp criticism from the conservative Global Anglican Future Conference, made up largely of churches in Africa and Asia that oppose moves towards same-sex blessings and women's leadership, the bloc this month abandoned earlier plans to appoint a parallel figurehead to rival Canterbury, opting instead to establish a new council. The body, which will include bishops, clergy, and lay members with voting rights, brings together provinces that have distanced themselves from Canterbury. The Anglican Consultative Council, a global representative body, also dropped a proposal for a rotating presidency, a move that would have reduced Canterbury's traditional leadership role, after concerns it could create a rival center of authority. Tensions between progressive and conservative Christians are not unique to Anglicanism, but the Archbishop's role is largely symbolic and relies on persuasion, unlike the Pope, who exercises clear authority over Catholics worldwide. Recent archbishops have struggled to bridge deep divisions over LGBTQ issues and women's leadership between the increasingly progressive Church of England and more traditional provinces elsewhere. Mullally has emphasized unity in diversity, telling Reuters in October last year, "We're a family with a shared root, and with any global church, there is great diversity in it." The Church of England broke from Rome nearly 500 years ago. Since then, the Archbishop of Canterbury has been the symbolic head of the Anglican Communion, which has expanded worldwide through missionary activity, particularly in countries that were once part of the British Empire. From Yahoo, reality TV thrives on messy people, but the Taylor-Frankie-Paul backlash reveals when audiences finally draw the line. What once felt like compelling controversy became something else entirely, forcing both viewers and producers to reassess. By Kerry Justich. Taylor-Frankie-Paul didn't become a reality TV star in spite of controversy. She became one because of it. On The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, her messy, highly public personal life wasn't a backstory. It was the premise. The show leaned into it. Audiences responded. And the formula of taking someone already generating attention online and giving that attention a bigger stage worked. Then, The Bachelorette tried to follow the same playbook. When Paul was announced as the lead for the long-time running ABC franchise last September, both the public and the network were aware of her past. The mom of three was known for a soft-swinging scandal that led to the dissolution of her marriage to Tate Paul and was introduced to television screens through the lens of her 2023 arrest following an altercation with her then-boyfriend, Dakota Mortensen. What viewers knew about Paul, the good, the bad, and the ugly, only fed their curiosity. Reality TV has long depended on that dynamic. Controversy as a draw, not a deterrent. But the past weeks exposed the limit of that logic when TMZ released video of the 2023 incident. The swift shift in public opinion of Paul and the unprecedented cancellation of her Bachelorette season days before it was set to premiere wasn't about new information. It was about how that information was experienced. What had been a watchable drama suddenly became unwatchable. Now, media experts say, it's not about where the line is, but when viewers decide it's been crossed. The appeal of messy TV. Paul's selection as the Bachelorette initially raised eyebrows. She was a single mother of three, with no prior ties to the franchise, known largely for the volatility of her past relationships. But for a series struggling to maintain relevance, the choice was strategic. Reality TV has increasingly trained audiences to see controversy not as a liability, but as a compelling narrative. There is something to the controversy that draws people in. Vasilis Dalikas, a marketing professor at Point Loma Nazarene University, who has studied this phenomenon, tells Yahoo, "There is something to their behavior or their personality that automatically makes them more interesting to watch." The pull isn't always easy to articulate, but Dalikas points to the schadenfreude, the pleasure derived from someone else's misfortune, as a key part of it. "We're watching with the hope that justice is restored," he says. That can mean wanting to see a controversial figure face consequences, but it can also mean hoping for the opposite, a redemption arc. Reality TV thrives on both impulses at once: the desire to see someone struggle and the possibility that they might change. There are people who are truly wishing this is a chance for them to get everything together, Dalikas says. Paul fit neatly into that framework. Her online presence was built on openness about a chaotic personal life, and the secret lives of Mormon wives turned that into something that viewers could actively interpret. Was she driving the chaos or caught in it? That ambiguity didn't deter audiences. It gave them a reason to keep watching. Jasmine Wegg, a New York-based attorney and host of the podcast Exhibit A List, says that kind of visibility is exactly what reality TV looks for. Paul was fascinating to people because she was putting it all out there, and TV bought into that, Wegg tells Yahoo. Shows aren't just willing to include that mess, they're structured around it. From Real Housewives to Vanderpump Rules, questionable, even ugly behavior has become part of the draw. In that context, casting Paul wasn't a departure. Even if she felt outside of the Bachelorette's realm, it was a continuation of a formula that works. But this time it came with real-life consequences. When it becomes problematic. The rapid unraveling of Paul's casting reveals what's uncomfortable about reality TV. The line between messy and problematic isn't set at the start. It's discovered in real time by audiences and producers alike, only often after it's been crossed. Paul's past has existed as public information that viewers could process at a distance. Viewers had previously seen body cam footage of the 2023 incident, which was aired in the debut episode of The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives in September 2024, followed by Paul's own expression of remorse. But the recent release of footage from the physical dispute itself, which shows Paul throwing a chair at Mortensen with her young daughter seemingly nearby, shifted the conversation. There's this notion of visually undeniable evidence, Delacus says, "The moment we have that, for most people, that's when it's crossed the line." That distinction between knowing and seeing matters. As Wegg put it, people can sit with something that exists in a document, even if it's uncomfortable. But when you actually see it in front of your own eyes, you can't really look away. What might have been framed as a storyline or backstory no longer feels contained within the show. At that point, you're not watching for Schadenfreude anymore. You're just upset that the show is even happening, Dalakas says. That shift forces producers to respond. Controversy translates into engagement, but producers are hoping it never reaches the point where it's gone too far. They will tolerate certain behavior, whether it's erratic or outrageous, adds Wegg. But if it comes to the line where the person doesn't look like they're doing well on TV, it's just no longer good TV. It's no longer about buzz or ratings, but about risk to the show, to its advertisers, and to its network's image. It's not necessarily a moral line, Wegg says. It's thinking about how this will play out for the show. That line is rarely fixed, though cases involving domestic violence raise the stakes in a way that extends beyond entertainment, says Katie Ray Jones, CEO of the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Domestic violence is not just a plot line or press hook. It's an epidemic. We live in a culture where shock and trauma drive clicks and views. In that skewed version of reality, people may forget that victims and survivors of domestic violence, their families and loved ones, are watching and listening, Ray Jones says. I wish it didn't take a public display of crisis and violence to spur a response. 10 million people experience domestic violence every year. No one should feel as if they are alone, and all those who choose to cause harm should be held accountable, regardless of who they are or how many followers they have. Moments like this expose a tension at the center of a genre that relies on real people and real experiences, yet packages them for consumption. When those experiences involve undeniable harm, that framing becomes harder to justify. There's a question we all have to ask ourselves about whether we're comfortable finding entertainment in someone's real struggles, says Wegg. We all have to decide where to draw that line. For Paul, this was it. From the New York Times Magazine, Ashes and Ice by Maggie Shipstead. My mother asked me to scatter her remains in Antarctica. It was a trip I'll never forget. On the ship I boarded at the bottom of Argentina with the three men I love most, I put my socks in a drawer, my sweaters on a shelf, and my mother's ashes in the cupboard above the mini-fridge. They were in a clear plastic bag, inside a blue plastic box I'd ordered from Amazon, emblazoned with stickers that said, "Created, cremated remains," and "Fly safe." This would be my third trip to Antarctica. The first was in 2016, from New Zealand to the Ross Sea, at the beginning of a relationship with a man who led commercial voyages to remote regions. In a journey of 5 weeks, we had days and days of big seas, the swells sometimes topping 30 feet. Tending bar in the evenings, I developed a technique for mixing simple cocktails with my feet braced wide, moving my pouring hand with the roll of the ship. Discomfort was a small price to pay for witnessing the Ross, a seldom visited part of Antarctica, 1,800 miles south of New Zealand. When I remember what I saw, a full moon rising over the trans-Antarctic mountains, their snowy summits pink with midnight dusk, emperor penguins, steam-bait-breathing volcanoes, explorers' huts still intact, tabular icebergs the size of cities, my chest still constricts with something piquant and not easily identifiable, maybe longing. So glorious was the Ross that when I accepted a magazine assignment to travel to the Antarctic Peninsula in 2019, I had snobbishly low expectations. The peninsula is separated from South America only by the relatively narrow 600-mile Drake Passage. And despite the Drake's notoriously stormy weather, it remains by far the most accessible part of Antarctica and the destination for an overwhelming majority of visitors. I thought of it as Antarctica Light. But I could bring a guest. By then, my mother had been living with chronic lymphatic leukemia for 11 years, and despite a recent setback, she really wanted to go. Her doctor timed her treatments so she could be away for a month, time we spent mostly on a cruise ship, bouncing down the Chilean coast to Antarctica and back up to Buenos Aires. One morning, we awoke to a grayscale landscape, rock, ice, cloud. In the photo I took of Mom on our balcony, her hands are balled into fists, pressed to her heart, her smile tremulous. When we first stepped ashore, she said she wanted to kiss the briny pebbles under her boots. She wanted to do everything. She hiked in the snow. She kayaked. She fell in love with penguins, especially the saucy, knee-high gentoos with thick white markings above their eyes like Ernest Borgnine brows. I was chastened by the peninsula's austere, extreme beauty. Here, like the Ross, was a place that would kill you without noticing. A place that made you feel tiny and vulnerable. Its fearsome grandeur offering access to the sublime. When we sailed north, away, Mom embraced me in our cabin and cried. When she got home, she ordered a vanity license plate for her car that read Gentoo 1. What a gift that time was. Just the two of us, a year before COVID and 3 years before she died. We hadn't traveled as a pair since the late 90s, the summer before I started high school. She'd gotten us Ural passes and let me choose where we went. When I led us on a multi-day pilgrimage into the Swiss Alps to visit a monastery I'd seen in a 40-year-old issue of National Geographic, she didn't bat an eye. A year later, deep in a Russian history obsession, I talked her into taking me to St. Petersburg for the cathedral reburial of Tsar Nicholas II and his family, amid clanging bells and a procession of hearses along the Neva. We wanted to see a place, she taught me, is a good enough reason to go. Late one night in September 2020, Mom texted me. She'd just finished reading the proofs of my third novel, Great Circle, then 8 months from publication. The book is about a fictional pilot named Marion Graves, whose remains end up in the Southern Ocean. GC is a memorable, stick-to-your-heart story, she wrote, as though I'd asked her to supply a blurb for the book jacket. It inspired a very personal decision, which I think I'm ready to tell you when I see you next. I had no idea what she could mean. A few weeks later, I drove down to San Diego from Los Angeles and sat with her in her sewing room, her sanctum sanctorum, stuffed with fabric destined for quilts. On the wall hung a framed photo of the two of us on an icy beach, Gentoos in the background. Mom's eyes shone, and her voice broke as she told me that Great Circle had made her more comfortable with the idea of death. "And so," she said, "when I die, I want my ashes scattered off Antarctica with Marion's." What I wish I had done was ask Mom what being in that water would mean to her. Instead, my immediate, unflattering gut reaction was that Antarctica was my thing. I had been fascinated with it since I was a kid. I had had a life-changing romance there. I had written Great Circle. I also knew such a dispersal wouldn't be simple. A dense mesh of rules and regulations governs Antarctica. Most fundamental is the Antarctic Treaty, which has been in effect since 1961. A miracle of international cooperation and foresight that declared the whole continent shall be used for peaceful purposes only and be dedicated to nature and science. Much hashing out has ensued over the decades, and the body that oversees tourism, the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators, IIATO, has seen the complexity of its task skyrocket, along with visitor numbers, from around 6,400 when it was established in 1991 to 118,000 last year. While IIATO helps prevent greedy and careless humans from doing stupid and destructive things, for example, scattering ashes willy-nilly, its bureaucracy can be formidable. I wish I'd acknowledged that I found her idea beautiful. Instead, I went straight for the practicalities. "It's illegal to scatter ashes on land," I said, "but I think you could do it in the ocean." She waved her hands. "Sure, fine. I'm not going to die tomorrow anyway." That was the last we ever spoke of it. She died 647 days later, on June 3, 2022, of a cerebral hemorrhage caused by complications of her leukemia. With 130 passengers, our ship, the Greg Mortimer, was smallish among its peers, dwarfed by the three other tourist vessels in Port Ushuaia, Argentina. I liked its unromantic name in this region of gorgeously evocative ones: Tierra del Fuego, Cape Horn, Deception Island, Greg. As we got underway through the glassy, smooth Beagle Channel, my husband Tim lay in our cabin doing a crossword puzzle on his iPad and waiting to get seasick. Ever since a long-ago bachelor party fishing debacle, he had been convinced that any contact with the ocean would render him violently and irreversibly ill. My father and my brother, Matthew, had the next cabin through a communicating door we never opened. Amped and restless, I bustled off to explore. Matthew was on the top deck, and we stood together at the railing. All around were the brooding wild islands of Tierra del Fuego, Chile, to starboard and Argentina to the port. Magellanic penguins porpoised in and out of the sea like winged rugby balls. It was January, the height of Southern Hemisphere summer, but we were in down jackets. "This is where Mom first saw penguins," I told Matthew. I had this urge throughout the trip to play tour guide, beckoning the others into my memories of Mom in this place, wishing they could have witnessed the deep pleasure she'd taken in it. Soon after Mom's death, I'd brought up the whole Antarctica ashes thing with Dad and Matthew, hoping maybe she had also mentioned it to them. She had not, and they reacted with politely tempered incredulity, as though I announced she'd been speaking to me through the vacuum cleaner. Later, musing, my father said, "We'll have to think about where to scatter Mom's ashes." I was immediately annoyed. Hadn't he been listening? Did he not believe me? For that matter, why had Mom left me with the, I know this sounds crazy, but, task of conveying her wishes? I repeated sharply what I'd said about Antarctica, adding, "Remember?" Not until much later would I understand how easily my anger could feed off my grief. Nor did I consider that my father might have been hurt by his wife of 52 years confiding in me, but not in him. He blinked. "Yeah, but I don't know how serious she was." "She had seemed serious to me," I said. I described the emotional announcement in her sewing room. Her idea might have been outlandish, but it was the only specific after-death wish she'd expressed. I didn't see how we could brush it off. Dad stared at me, amusement seeping through his skepticism. In my family, fraught moments are perfectly valid opportunities for jokes. "Well," he said, "it's a good thing she's being cremated, because otherwise, right now, we'd be putting you on a tramp steamer bound for the southern seas." A year passed after Mom's death before I began considering how to get the ashes to the Antarctic. Another before I began trying to plan in earnest, and 18 months more before we went, this January. There had been dead ends along the way. Expedition companies were leery of my plan to write about the ashes, because they would have to trust me to accurately convey their compliance with IAATO's rules. Matthew was easy to enlist, and Dad surprised me, after some hemming and hawing, by signing on, too. "Tim," I coerced. While I was glad for the company, and warmed by the idea that Mom's loved ones would see Antarctica because of her, getting four people with four different travel styles to Antarctica upped the difficulty level by several orders of magnitude. "This wasn't my idea," I kept saying whenever anyone got frustrated with the complexities, but we all knew it might as well have been. I had taken Mom to Antarctica in the first place, and I'd relayed her wishes and vouched for their sincerity. By telling me, and only me, Mom had put me squarely in charge. I don't think Dad, Matthew, or I had fully comprehended how load-bearing my mother was within our family structure until we found ourselves left in the rubble. Rebuilding had taken time and painful effort. When my brother went through a challenging period, my father, in his 70s, took up the mantle of primary parent for the first time, flying to see him, calling me to worry and talk things through. I became the curator and disseminator of Mom's stuff, the decider of what was for dinner, the host and grand arbiter of Christmas. Sometimes I chafed at gendered assumptions that certain responsibilities of the organizing, feeding, planning variety would naturally fall to me because I was the woman. I decided not to have children, partly because I didn't want to be a caretaker. But my rejection of that role had been easier when Mom, the apex caretaker, was alive. She'd been so good at taking care of us that complacently we'd thought we were taking care of ourselves, like toddlers helping in the kitchen. The first night on the Greg Mortimer, our swells topped out at 12 feet, modest for the Drake Passage, but enough for the ship to roll. I slept badly, worried that Tim would get sick or forget a cardinal rule of rough seas, which is to not hold on to any door jams for balance, as doors can fly shut and break or sever your fingers. He'd never wanted to come on this trip and had dreaded it to the point of panic, but I strong-armed him into it because I selfishly wanted his company. Maybe I'd harbored a dream that one legacy of my mom's request might be Tim discovering he loves the polar regions as I do, despite his insistence that he would not. We awoke the first morning from a barfless night, fingers intact, and stared at each other in wonder. Either a miracle had occurred, or the prescription anti-nausea patch behind his ear had worked. "I don't even know who I am anymore," he said. "A natural-born seafarer," I said. He made a yuck face. That afternoon, the expedition staff told me we needed to scatter the ashes before we passed through the Antarctic convergence, the marine zone where very cold water coming from the south meets less cold sub-Antarctic waters. In practice, this meant we had to be north of 60 degrees south latitude, roughly the southern edge of the convergence and exactly the northern edge of the area governed by the Antarctic Treaty and IAATO. And that meant we needed to disperse the ashes before the end of the day. It was decided, 8:30 p.m., deck 4, port side aft. Before dinner, my father and I went to a lecture on marine mammals. Afterward, "About Mom and her request," he said, "I always wish she'd told me, because I would have tried to talk her out of it." "Probably," I said, "that's why she didn't tell you." He smiled, rueful. "Probably." After dinner, I took the blue TSA-approved travel box into our cabin's bathroom and sat on the shower floor. I pulled out the heavy bag of ashes, stretched a hole in the plastic with my thumbs, and emptied the white grit into a cardboard scattering tube with a perforated top. Another Amazon funerary purchase. The blue box had traveled all the way from Los Angeles in my carry-on, every security check making my heart race like I was smuggling a kilo of cocaine. Cinezas humanas, I'd explained to the Argentine customs agents, proffering my mother's death certificate. They asked what I was going to do with them. When I said I was going to Antarctica and throw them in the ocean, they shrugged me on my way. In the United States, with very few exceptions, cremations take place in kiln-like incinerators called retorts, at temperatures high enough to combust human tissues into gases and particles. What's left is not really ashes, but bone in chunks and fragments, and the residue of whatever casket was used. This is all poured into an industrial machine called a cremulator and pulverized into the grit and powder we call ashes. The term has the right redolence. Dryness, aftermath, a gray and final alchemy. But both the word and the substance seem perhaps too inert and processed, eluding the truth of the profound transition that has occurred. Cremation is a means of circumventing decay, of turning flesh into portable, disposable remains. When you bury a body, you're done with it. But ashes require another step, another decision. Do you bury them under a headstone, as my paternal grandparents had requested, so mourners have a place to leave flowers? Do you scatter them in a beloved forest, as my maternal grandparents wanted? You could forget them in a closet, or you could embark on a quest, a trial of perseverance and devotion, ending in a cold and faraway stretch of ocean. The evening was windy and golden when the four of us stepped out onto the deck near the stern. The swells trailed veils of foam. When Mom imagined being scattered off Antarctica, I think she probably pictured the peninsula's mountains and glaciers. But this, the open ocean of 59 degrees south latitude, was the best we could do. The Antarctic conversion has its own metaphorical weight. It's a zone of transition and mixing, of upwelling nutrients that sustain an ecosystem. Through these waters, the Antarctic circumpolar current circles eastward, more powerful than any other ocean current, stirring together the southern waters of the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans. Matthew stood wiping his eyes. Tim took photos. My father talked about how Mom's request hadn't made sense to him until he learned that Antarctica had eased her fear of death. She never, ever wanted anything to do with the Big D, he said. But if Antarctica, or the idea of Antarctica, had given solace, then he understood. I read the lines from Great Circle about Marion's ashes, the lines Mom had read and claimed for herself. She's in the ocean now as she was meant to be. Most of her has come to rest, scattered on the cold southern seafloor. But some of her smallest, lightest fragments, floating dust, are still being carried along by the currents. I held the cardboard tube out over the railing, into the wind, and shook it. Heavier bits fell to the water, while a powdery white plume blew out over the ship's wake. Matthew and Dad took turns scattering, and when there wasn't much left, I pulled the two halves of the tube apart and set the last of her free. For months, when people had asked how I would feel after scattering the ashes, I always said, without hesitation, relieved. But what I actually felt, sharp and unexpected, was loss. By the time we left, I was eager, almost desperate, to shed the burden of it all. I had said many times to many people that if Mom had any inkling of what a colossal hassle she was saddling me with, logistics, expense, carbon guilt, sheepdog tasks like making sure the men all had travel insurance and waterproof pants, she would have instantly rescinded her request. But that's part of what's beautiful, my friend Mika said, because she probably made choices to take up less space lots of times in her life. This knocked me back. Mom was a woman, a wife, a mother, a teacher, a middle child, a Midwesterner by upbringing, the daughter of a Unitarian minister and a kindergarten teacher, a perfect storm of nice girl self-denial. Her way of living had been modest and grounded, which made her vision for her remains only more mysterious to me. Grief is sneaky and shape-shifting, and like the proverbial elephant in the dark room, impossible to perceive in its entirety. But I'd thought of loss as more finite and external, a discrete event in which my living present mother had been taken away and replaced with an irrevocable absence. Until I shook the last of her physical being into the wind and water, I thought I was done losing her. In actuality, the unfinished obligation of her ashes had staved off a certain finality. The ashes had seemed like a burden when they'd really been a tether, held taut across death's divide. Once I fulfilled my promise, that connection was severed. Clutching the empty cardboard scattering tube, I turned to Tim, crying, and said, "She's really gone." An obvious fact, and yet a revelation. She could ask nothing else of me, and I could give her nothing. And there we were, the four of us, our jackets lightly powdered with ash, and our mission accomplished, oddly enough, still at the beginning of a trip to Antarctica. We saw all the stuff, the mountains and the ice, the penguins and the seals. The sun set, but the sky stayed light. Humpback whales, once hunted almost to extinction in these waters, frolicked with their calves. A Canadian woman lost the meaty tip of her finger to a slamming door. Matthew and I did the polar plunge, jumping off the back of the ship into water so cold it felt like fire. The four of us mostly kept to ourselves, partly because we're not minglers, and partly because explaining our reason for the trip proved to be a whole thing. My father haunted the decks, taking a million scenic pictures with his iPhone 5. Tim gradually became famous among the staff members as word spread that he writes for The Simpsons. Though we sensed bewilderment as well, that a person responsible for so much humor and fun could be so unenthusiastic about being in Antarctica. "It's insane to come all the way down here and not go outside," I told him one morning when he chose to skip a wildlife spotting outing on Zodiacs, the rugged outboard-powered rafts used to get passengers off the ship. "I've been outside," he protested. "If it means a lot to you, I'll go, but it's not my thing." Exasperated, I went without him, convinced he was being stubborn and contrary, and robbing himself of life's Antarctic joys. But then, bouncing over choppy waves in a Zodiac and getting splashed in the face with freezing salt water, in order to see elephant seals lying like logs on a beach, absolutely my idea of a good time. I realized Tim had protected both of us by not coming. He would have been miserable, and his misery would have diminished my happiness. So he didn't love Antarctica. So what? To come on the trip at all, certain as he was that he was condemning himself to death by seasickness, had been an act of bravery, his presence a declaration of devotion. I had thought when Mom died that I would probably end up scattering the ashes alone. That would have been simpler. I would have fretted much less about travel arrangements and dinner conversation and whether the men were having a nice time, and if not, if they resented me for it. Simpler, but so sad. Sad to be the only one to remember the golden light on the sea and her ashes hanging in the air. Sad to return alone on a ship of strangers, to a place where her joy and mine had amplified each other. It was an act of care that my father and brother didn't let that happen. Their presence, too, signified devotion, not just to my mother, but to me. Now I am home, and Mom is still in the Southern Ocean, motes of her drifting over unknowable distances. I think she thought of being scattered in that faraway water as a means of self-erasure, the exchange of bodily cohesion for oneness with a place that moved her. But inevitably, it was a statement of self, too. Her wish was a posthumous revision, an author's note. I was not quite the person you thought I was. A few months after she died, we had a normal sort of memorial service for her, with family and friends, eulogies and canapes. It was lovely and moving, a fitting way of honoring the woman we all knew. Antarctica was how we honored what we didn't know. From Business Insider, Anne Hathaway, 43, says she stopped being a stressed person for her kids and everyone around her. By Amanda Goh. Anne Hathaway, 43, says she decided not to go through life feeling stressed all the time. The actor said she's been rethinking the way she handles pressure, particularly while leading The Devil Wears Prada sequel. You can't have a good time at a party if the hostess is stressed or if she's letting her stress show, Hathaway told Harper's Bazaar. I just decided that it wasn't fair for me to move through my life as a stressed person. I don't want my kids to be around it. I don't want my friends to be around it. I don't want strangers to be around it. I don't want people I work with to be around it, she said. Hathaway said she's done a lot of work to process everything coming her way differently, so it feels exciting rather than overwhelming. She added that she sees her career in two phases, an earlier chapter that left little room for anything outside work, and a second chapter shaped by parenthood, sobriety, and being more present. Before, there was this focus that was really uncompromising and uninterrupted, she said. And I just can't tell you anymore what life is like without kids, because kids interrupt you all the time. That's why she no longer tries to keep everything perfectly in sync, she said. My friends and I talk about it a lot, and we actually feel very defeated by the concept of balance, Hathaway said. If the weight shifts in one direction, then you have to bounce it up on the other side. And we find that if it winds us up, as opposed to making us steady. Instead, she said, we seek to harmonize our life. Hathaway isn't the only high-profile parent rethinking how to deal with stress. Reese Witherspoon has said raising her older children taught her what's not worth stressing over as she parents her youngest. I've been parenting for 25 years. I also feel very comfortable that I know the little things that aren't as important. Like I had a friend say, I'm not there for pickup, and is that okay? Absolutely. You know, you can't be at every soccer game, every morning meeting, pick up, drop off, make the lunch, do the volunteer stuff, Witherspoon said. Grey's Anatomy star Camilla Luddington has said that juggling and work and kids doesn't come with a sense of balance. To take the pressure off, I'll be like, you know what? Today, I'm probably going to be better at my job than I am at parenting, because I'm on set all day. But tomorrow I'm off, and I can be a better parent, Luddington said. Letting go of that need to be perfectly balanced all the time has been very freeing for me. And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.